There's a roller coaster rolling over me in my nightmares of the peony. No matter how hard I tried, I still almost always died. Try not to fall off the side, the wild mouse ride. The wild mouse ride. How many barely survived? Traumatized for the rest of their lives. There's a roller coaster rolling over me. There's a roller coaster rolling over me.
Hello and welcome to Unceded Airwaves, hosted by the Indigenous Collective. I'm Danny.
And I'm Olivia.
I'm Audrey.
And we are grateful to be broadcasting to you from the current territory of the Musqueam First Nation, but the historical territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish people in the city colonially labeled as Vancouver. Today we'll be talking about Indigenous economics with a focus on two figures that I just have a lot of personal experience with, not necessarily that they're the two figureheads of Indigenous economics. I'm just very familiar with these fellas. So first we'll be talking about Chief Clarence Louis of the Osoyoos Indian Band, which is where I grew up. And he kind of has this, I've labeled it, pull yourself up by your moccasins capitalism. And then we'll be talking about Dr. Charles Menzies, who is a professor here at UBC and has more of a Marxist approach to Indigenous economics. So first I want to just get into Chief Clarence Louis and who he is. He's the author of the bestseller Res Rules, and I grew up under his rule, I might say, and I'm very lucky. I don't consider myself someone reconnecting because of all of the policy Chief Clarence put into place, and he did do a lot. So we'll start with, at 24 years old, he was elected as chief of the Osoyoos Indian Band. And just to clarify, Indian is typically just a term used in legal jargon. So a lot of nations, it's either blank First Nation or blank Indian Band. So that's where that comes from. I'll use OIB because that's what we call it at home. We just shorten it to OIB. So I'll say OIB from here on. The band has 460 members and controls 32,000 acres of land. He started the Osoyoos Indian Band Development Corporation, OIBDC, which I worked for this summer, in 1988.
Through the corporation's efforts, the previously impoverished band started or acquired 9 businesses, including tourism, construction, and recreation companies. The band now employs 700 people, including non-First Nations, a high-profile business started by the OIB. During Louis' tenure in NCMEP Cellars.
NCMEP. All good. NCMEP Cellars.
We're learning. And the first Aboriginal-owned winery in North America. Louis has served 10 terms as of 2012, winning every election but one since 1985.
He consulted with Federal Finance Minister Jim Flaherty in 2008 on matters of economic development. He's a two-term chair of the National Aboriginal Economic Development Board. In 2003, Louis was chosen by the U.S. Department of State as one of 6 Canadian First Nations leaders to review economic development in American Indian communities. In 2004, he received the Order of British Columbia. Louis has also been involved in land claim settlements with the provincial government. He was given the Freedom of the Town of Oliver, British Columbia on July 21st, 2017.
He is a big part in the Canadian Business Hall of Fame. They're big, big Chief Clarence fangirls, as a lot of economists and that non-Indigenous economists that have interest in Indigenous economics. They really love this guy. So this is from the Canadian Business Hall of Fame. So these are quotes from them. So it's basically everything we just said, but I wanted to emphasize kind of the tone they use here. Chief Louis has consistently emphasized economic development as a means to improve his people's standard of living. Under his direction, the band has become a multifaceted corporation. That's really important. OIB is a corporation, like, fully. And it's not really a hidden thing. If you go on the res, there's, like, these capitalist slogans everywhere. And in our doc here, it shows the band office, which literally says on it, Native people have always worked for a living. And the elementary school gymnasium has a giant slogan that says, join the real world, go to school, or get a job. Mm-hmm. And then a Soyuz Indian Man Development Corporation. So he's been using that to form as many for-profit organizations as possible. And this is mostly through wineries and resorts. Unlike in America, where this kind of Indigenous economics is typically facilitated through casinos. So they employ a ton of non-First Nations people and First Nations and Métis people from all different bands. That is my case. I'm not OIB, but I worked for OIB this summer. Mm-hmm. And I worked for a summer day camp program that was operated through OIB. And it's literally one example of his policy being a very good thing, because it's very inexpensive for band members and it provides childcare throughout the summer. But also we got to go on field trips pretty much every single day all across the valley to lakes and fun water parks and all kinds of things. So we'll start here. The band has also negotiated settlement of 3 specific land claims, negotiated over 1,000 acres of lease developments, and acquired hundreds of acres of land to add to the reserve. One thing before we get into what they've modeled in sustainable business development is that when the OIB Reserve was created in the early 1900s, there was absolute outrage by the white settlers at just how big the reserve is. It is huge, and for such a small population, so it is like kind of, it goes into the mountains, and it is such a vast area, and there was a lot of upset about that and how it was prime real estate for corporations and whatnot. Mm. Next, we'll get into what else the Canadian Business Hall of Fame had to say about what they model.
Yeah, so in December 1984, Clarence Louis was first elected as chief of the Soyuz Indian Band.
Okay, so
I lost my place.
All good. So they've modeled, according to the Canadian Business Hall of Fame, not only sustainable business development, but also socioeconomic development, which is what I was talking about earlier. Benefits to the community have included developing a new preschool daycare, which I went to when I was in preschool, and it's completely cultural. And it's separate to the public and private school systems. It's First Nation schools are separate. The community also has a brand new school as of the like late 90s, which I worked at also. And it is a very traditional cultural school where they have drum circles every single day. They follow the traditional calendar. And from preschool, they take Tsleil-Waututh language class every single day. A healthcare center, social services building, a youth center, and a cultural center.
Okay, I'm finally on track. Chief Louis is a strong proponent of First Nations communities becoming business-oriented to create their own jobs and revenue sources. Not just administering government programs, he also believes that First Nations leaders have a responsibility to incorporate First Nations language and culture in all socioeconomic initiatives as the means to improve and protect their heritage.
Chief Louis's efforts have been widely recognized. He's been named Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year and is a member of the Aboriginal Business Hall of Fame. He's also received the Order of British Columbia and the Order of Canada.
This is a quote from him, and we will really get into this. One thing that frustrates me about Chief Clarence's policy is not only does he try to exploit capitalism for the benefit of Indigenous people, which I'm in support of, like finding ways to get into the system and use it to build stronger communities, mm-hmm. but he has this narrative of trying to paint that we have always been capitalist and that is our nature. And it was very much starting in the 90s trying to appease the heavy racism. So, but it never died out, and he still is very strong on that. He spoke at my girlfriend and I, both of our separate Indigenous grad ceremonies who are a year apart, and the parents were eating it up. He was like, you guys are going to have to get off your butts and go to work and get a real job, and you're going to be strong Indigenous people that have a work ethic. And he went off about welfare and all of these stereotypes. This is a quote from him. Every First Nation society that I've studied, we all come from a working culture. Our people worked for a living. They got up early and went to work, whether it was on the trap lines or whether it was in the fur trade. I'm not looking for handouts. I'm looking for self-sufficiency for my people. And another quote from an article. His advice to young men on his home reserve. Get a damn job. Be a man. It should be embarrassing for you to raise your kids on welfare. Looking to succeed in the workplace? Be punctual. Be on time. Indian time doesn't cut it. Deciding what to read? Too many times I go into Indian people's houses, even on my own res, I see tabloids. Tabloids? That's what you read? You're never going to be a leader reading tabloids. He's very sassy.
Yeah. It almost seems like there's some like internalized stuff going on there.
Yes, definitely. Especially with him saying that quote, when I go into Indian people's houses, which that is weird.
That is bizarre.
He does often talk, it's not in our document, but he does often talk about his mom. And I used to, his mom used to be a regular at my work, and she is very sweet, but like mean. And she does not have like any of his, like she disagrees with him all the time. And he talks about that a lot, how she doesn't like his whole very like strict and mean and like very kind of Ronald Reagan welfare state-esque like get up and work and the harmful stereotypes and just trying to paint us as capitalist people, like that phrase about how we used to work on the trap lines or in the fur trade, and you could unpack that for so long.
That's interesting that his family doesn't share the same views, because I feel like a lot of the time, especially when it's like internalized stuff, it's easy to get that from like family members or relatives. But that's interesting that she does not agree with him.
Yeah. So this is, we'll have a bit more of a discussion right now before we get into Dr. Menzies about Chief Clarence. So the OIB Reserve has these leases that they've created. So it's a really interesting model. So it's absolutely destroying the wetlands around Soyuz Lake. And if you actually see the pictures, it's pretty horrifying of how cramped it is and what it looks like. But if you've ever driven around BC, possibly even in Alberta, You've probably seen these giant white lawn chairs that say a Soyuz cottages. Mm. And those are the OIB cottages that Chief Clarence, they're still building more and more and more. They're at full capacity. And you would pay as much for these as you would pay for a very nice place and a very nice mortgage. But the thing is, after 100 years, it returns back to the band. So none of these people, and it's mostly old, generationally wealthy white people, they will not be passing on these houses to their kids, their descendants. It just goes back to the band. And it honestly makes me really sad, like, driving past it. Mila and I go for drives up there all the time, and it's, like, these beautiful sage flats and sweetlum harvesting grounds, and then you just, there's the cottages, and it's just this block along the wetlands, and they're still doing more and more and more construction. Another thing is, I believe, could be wrong about the statistic, or this could be out of date, but the Okanagan region is the region in Canada that uses the most water per capita. It's a desert, but we are the wine capital of Canada. Oliver, BC, where OIB is located, is the wine capital of Canada. And OIB owns multiple huge wineries. You may have heard of Spirit Ridge Resort, Inniskillen Wines, in Kameep Cellars. These are huge, and they employ so many people. And it is just completely destroying the ecosystem, this agriculture. But going home in the summer, I see the effects. I see that the kids I work with, their parents have jobs with the band. Mm-hmm. They have secure housing. They have secure jobs. And these kids are growing up. So it is so healing working with kids on OIB because they are so, like, next level involved in the culture because of the policies put in. You may have heard of ELTMA in Penticton, PIB. There were a bunch of Native influencers that, like, went there last year, I think, to surprise the kids. And it followed his same model. And there's dual signage in all public schools in the South Okanagan, in Itzelchin and English. And that's been a thing since I was in preschool. I learned the Okanagan song, which is almost like a land acknowledgement in song, years before I ever heard O Canada, because I went to the preschool on the res. And it works. I was raised culturally. I was raised harvesting, and I was raised with all of these things because of what he's done. But it's also kind of at what cost. There's a traditional fishing site that has been privatized, and I highly recommend looking up OK Falls traditional fishing site. There's this big hill that has a lot of chaptik, which is traditional stories, around it. And there are these people who not only are neutral, they are actively anti-Indigenous and put up a sign that said ceded territory, and they planted a huge Canadian flag. There was a huge case where they were putting spikes and wood boards with nails up in the river so kids couldn't fish there. And it's been a traditional fishing site for years and years and years. And this hill has so many stories around it, and they built this giant house on top of it. And just this year, they were able to purchase not the land that has the house on it. That's what they're really hoping for. All the kids I worked with this summer absolutely hate the people on the hill. They're just known as the racist old white lady, because she'll come out there and everyone hates her. But they were able to buy, like, privately. OIB bought part of that site. And now it's, like, been, they put up a ton of stuff, tons of ceremonies happening there. And they've been able to buy it back, like, privately. So it's really a question of at what cost.
I think both can exist at the same time. I mean, not the capitalist part, that's iffy. But it is good that they're, like, connecting with culture more. I think it's more of, like, the message behind it. Because I have a quote here from Chief Lawrence, or Louis. Oh my gosh, I forget his name. My brain is dead today. But be prepared, because this is really, really iffy. It says, this is his quote. It says, "It all comes down to the fact that you can't protect your heritage and culture when you're on welfare." So colonial.
Very. And I just looked up Chief Clarence Louis quotes. First one that comes up, "I want my people to have good jobs, good houses, and good cars. I want to see multimillionaire First Nations people, and I will argue with anyone who says being Indian means embracing being poor." He just sounds so misguided, and, like, he can't think about it deeply.
Yeah, and, like, no one ever says that, like, being Indigenous means being poor.
Exactly, it means embracing being poor. That's, like, very the welfare queen stereotype of the Reagan era.
Yes.
And just to say, like, you want to see multimillionaire First Nations people feels like that goes against all the principles of decolonization.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like, the way that he speaks about it, too, is very much, like, blaming Indigenous people for
everything
that, like, we have been through, like, in this country, and not considering the circumstances that have put so many Indigenous people in welfare.
Exactly.
It's, like, it's so ignorant.
It's so, it's literally that quote of Kim Kardashian, pardon, but saying, get your ass up and work. Nobody no, wants to literally. Work these days. It's, like, like, it's just blaming the people, and it just, it sucks because it's working, and he is, like, a god in the economics world, but it's so misguided, and I really like, as we'll get into later, Dr. Menzies' approach, which is understanding that two can exist at the same time. You can get within the system and try and change it to your benefit and employ the people without trying to paint us as inherently capitalists who are just, they need to get up and work. And he had this other speech, and it was specifically to young men of the band. And it was, get your man pants on. You need to get your man pants on and work.
Oh, my God.
It's very colonial. Very, very intersectional. I think there's a little bit of misogynist in there. A little
very
bit of racism.
So.
Very wild.
Yeah. It's really frustrating. And even his own mom, sweet Lucy, does not agree with him all the time.
We love Lucy. Lucy stands.
Shout out Lucy. Lucy is so sweet. I never actually knew that her son was the chief until randomly I connected the dots one day. She's just Lucy. She's very sweet. But yeah, the propaganda around the res is actually, like, baffling. Like, the literal slogans and signage, it's like, it feels so dystopian. And especially seeing a Soyuz Indian Band Development Corporation everywhere. And I remember briefly, I mean, I definitely shouldn't have, but bringing it up at, like, a Christmas dinner or something. It was Dakota. Oh, yeah. So it was like a what would you, like, distant kind of family member a little bit. And I got shut down immediately. It was the same, like, how could you say that when it's worked? Like, who cares if the wineries are, like, this is what people need. Like, what else are they supposed to do? And I think it's, like, it is really important that I, like, in academia, I'm like, ooh, it's so bad. It's so bad. But then I see the results, and I just feel, my final take is just, he needs a way better approach, and he needs to actually think critically about decolonization and our culture and how it's anti-consumerist. So for him to say he wants to see multimillionaire Native people with good cars and good houses is so consumerist and anti everything to do with land back and dealing with climate change.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is so random too, and I'm not saying this to make fun of him, but he looks like wholesome auntie.
He has a twinkle in his
yeah,
eye.
Yeah, he has a twinkle in his eyes, which I think is helping them because he looks so wholesome.
Yeah, like looking at
misleading. Yeah, misleading.
Very. There's a lot that is just so interesting. Like, the Native people have always worked for a living thing is everywhere. Like, this is where I used to go. I'm showing them a picture right now to pick up my paycheck, and there's another slogan saying, wow, Native people have always worked for a living. And, like, the speech at our ceremonies really kind of said it all. And in his book, he literally starts out with, I don't give a rat's ass if you want me to be politically correct. I'm going to be. And his book is called Res Rules, and the tagline is, My Indictment of Canada and America's Systemic Racism Against Indigenous People, which sounds great. And that is a lot of what he covers. He has dealt with a lot of systemic policy and has really changed that. But I feel like that's kind of misguided when he's known as the tough love guy. Well. We will get into Dr. Menzies, and I do remember taking ANTH 220 last year, which was Contemporary British Columbia Indigenous Studies with Dr. Menzies, and we went really deep into all of the very specific systemic things that Chief Clarence seems to ignore that play a really big role. Like, we covered the Fisheries Act in that class, and the Fisheries Act was a British colonial infrastructure that created a commercial economic market and indigenous economic market in the native economy. So it kind of started around 1871, and the goal was to capture indigenous fishing rights for the profit of the crown, claiming the resource as their own to exploit. So it criminalized indigenous fishing practices, and it really regulated everything to maintain colonial power, and it really made it so indigenous people who they saw were starting to build generational wealth, as well as Chinese laborers. So the two main demographics were Chinese laborers and indigenous laborers that were on track to build major generational wealth in the fisheries industry in BC. So there was very direct policy, the Fisheries Act, put in place to ensure that only white settlers built generational wealth in the fishery industry. And I want to go over, my helpers will help us explain what Dr. Menzies talks about with capitalism, the myth, and the reality.
Okay. Yeah. So the myth is based on the idea of economic freedom. It values, quote unquote, hard work. Owners create value and jobs, and that anyone can succeed.
And the reality is conflates economic freedom with democracy. It rewards like compliance, like who gets rewarded,
mm-hmm.
who benefits from this. It extracts value. It maintains success in a constrained environment by systematic oppression, and removes attachment to place, location, community, basically. And then capitalism, so much to unpack here, but basically it's like accumulation of wealth and resources, time, land, that is able to displace people.
Yeah, economically, without displacing them physically. The example given here is Kitsum Kalum being taken over by industrialists and the alienation of economic control and the relation of the, quote, traditional sector by colonial regime. Process of self-governance began in the 1980s. Neoliberalism relates to individual responsibility and also relates heavily to globalization and transnational corporations, reduction of government interference in daily lives of individuals, government involvement in the economy, government corporations engaging in the idea of one big global economy that is not able to be regulated by the national governments.
And Native social supports are heavily discouraged. Instead, focusing on high-cost services, not revenue-generated, cutting medical education costs, and encouraging privatization of these public areas.
Transfer of income opportunity, facilitating entrepreneurship over governmental authority to levy fees.
Mm-hmm. So I didn't put too much in detail here, but a big part, and I highly recommend taking ANTH 220 with Dr. Charles Menzies if you can, or just looking into his work.
Mm-hmm.
Impact benefit agreements are a very common kind of legal thing here, but the impact benefit agreement has kind of an underlying theme similar to just the idea of reconciliation as a whole, of especially in BC where it's unceded most of the territory here. It's kind of almost a trick, because if you make an impact benefit agreement, that would be the first time putting into writing that there is some sort of middle ground between the settlers and the indigenous people. Same with a lot of reconciliation policy. So on the surface, it seems very good, forming a relation, impact versus benefit, with the First Nation. So when they're creating an IBA, which is required for most projects and any corporation that wants to do drilling or anything that could interfere with anything, they only have to consult with the indigenous people if they see there being a risk. Otherwise, they don't have to. And impact benefit agreements are basically a very lousy kind of thing that only exists because of how wobbly the treaty issues are here. So some examples are the Haisla and Chevron in Kitimat partnership, which was like, that's very similar to OIB, has a lot of partnerships. Like there's one with a Tim Hortons that's on the res, and there's all of these different corporations that exist, and they pretty much every single time deem that the benefit outweighs any of the possible impact and negativity of that impact. So the purpose of IBAs is to reduce delays. You don't want First Nations taking you to court over rights and title. To mitigate the impacts, I put a quote here, destroy the planet, here's some cash. Certainty, once they start the game, nothing will change for the length of the project and nothing new will interfere with the business. Mutual profitability, each party is supposed to get something, but it should be about equitable profit. Addressing infringements of rights and titles, IBA, that's part of why IBAs are used, because it's basically like a contract that you sign, and then from then on out, that if you bring up any issues, it's like, oh, well, you signed the IBA, so we already figured it out. And it does not resolve the question of rights and title, and there's no authority. So it's kind of lurking in the background, driving this process of trying to basically the settler state taking over even more by forming, quote, reconciliation relationships.
Yeah, and some alternative approaches are not company capital centered, which is internal agreement based on Indigenous values first. So instead of like this indirect control with the companies trying to dodge the policy, it would be direct control, long-term plans, transgenerational.
Yeah, so I'll just go, my notes don't really make too much sense, but so slow it down. With making long-term plans, because a lot of these capitalist policies, like the lease that I mentioned, are very short-term. So it's about how much profit can I make in my lifetime? Because that's very much a colonialist mindset versus the Indigenous perspective, which is transgenerational, like time immemorial, like it's just a cycle of life of understanding that our lives are not valued more than those who come after us. But in this capitalist mindset, it's very, even if you acknowledge that, it's very, what can I make in my lifetime in this short amount of time? What can we do? What can we see happen? And that just is one example of how this kind of idea of reconciliation policy, no matter what, it will be anti-tradition. So there is a shift in economic benefits from profit to taxation model. So that would be a lot better. So rethinking the principles being applied and that money isn't everything. So instead of just focusing on what direct profit can they make, focusing on what can happen over time, and using taxation as a means to kind of balance things out a lot more, and supporting of land-based activities, cultural, agricultural, to encourage the people to stay where they are so they don't have to leave. So what we were talking about earlier with Kitsum Kalum, it basically became a corporate town. So everybody in that area was displaced from the res and was employed by through this IBA, and literally where they slept is where they work. Everything is completely connected and you just live to work. And this point is highlighting that it's super important for people to be able to form connection with the land and not have this super distant kind of mindset that capitalism and consumerism promotes. And it really detaches us from the land, which is our mother. We'd like to enhance customary government co-management agreements with government, provide another alternative. Without government, IBAs can't change governance issues. IBAs are limited to bilateral, so the proponent and the First Nation, and it does not go further than that. If Mila and I were talking about this earlier, about a different thing, but if we actually had self-government, it would look more like the First Nations getting to decide, for example. If I wanted harvesting rights, I'd have to have status and have these very specific requirements met, but how I think it should work is I grew up in OIV territory. I think you should be able to apply through the band and, you know, be vetted. Like, if people in the community know you and you are a part of that community, it should be up to the First Nation to say, hey, you can harvest sphelim in May because you are a part of us and you're a part of that. But that doesn't really work in the colonial structure where it needs very definite, very, very this. So self-government would look so much more different. And it's so far outside of what Chief Clarence seems to think of as possible. It seems to just be very surface level thinking, in my opinion. And then we'll get into active engagement, if you're able to pull that up. So this is where I absolutely love Dr. Menzies because he is so radical and he is just, I just love him. Shout out.
So we have active engagement, which includes militant direct action through reoccupation of traditional lands, living sovereign, refusing to be bound by colonial laws, tactical alliances, without a militant extreme edge, solutions devolve towards assimilation and accommodation and become more and more accommodation-led without the hard resistance create space for loyal opposition.
And then enacting sovereignty, examples of what that can look like, paying attention to the extent of land use and knowledge, reoccupying through traditional food collecting and harvesting, maintaining presence in spaces, and rematriation. I think the maintaining presence in spaces is really important, kind of ties back to what we were saying earlier about supporting land-based activities. And I also remember Dr. Menzies talking about that in the class and how like a lot of reserves are located very far away from mm-hmm. like economic centers and stuff like that, which makes it a lot harder to like work there. I think that's really important. I think that also ties into what we were saying earlier about blaming Indigenous people for their economic status when mm-hmm. they're not located in a place where that is as possible for
yeah.
them.
I think Dr. Renzi's work shows that there is another way of going at it without just going straight to these really big ideas that we tend to go to in academia of decolonization. And Dr. Menzies focuses really on what that actually looks like. Mm. And I wish Chief Clarence could take his class.
Honestly.
Like, exactly. I feel like it would really make him rethink. It's very that boomer idea. My dad is super very into that. He loves Chief Clarence. He's very into that, like, pull yourself up, get to work, get a job, and not really thinking further about that. Mm-hmm. And I really want to emphasize that phrase that he said about he wants to see First Nations people who are millionaires with big cars and big mm-hmm. houses, and that is so far from decolonization and what we actually want. We don't want consumerism. We don't want this hyper-capitalist state. Mm-hmm. And yes, I am wearing a cute little outfit and makeup, and I have a laptop in front of me, but that doesn't mean I can't criticize the system mm-hmm. that I'm living in and wish, like when I was a kid, I used to, growing up so traditionally, we would hear so many stories about what we'd say the old days. So many that you could literally put yourself there. So when I was a kid, I would kind of detach and daydream about being, I'm Otipemisok Nehiyawak, so that's like Saskatchewan area. But where I grew up, for some reason, I always imagined myself as a little silk child just running around playing stick games, playing double ball, and just like I literally would escape to this mind world. And like that's what I want. Like, I don't want to be in this hell late stage capitalist consumerist state. Mm-hmm.
I feel that so much. So I'm Métis, so my dad is very, very white, and it's not his fault, but he has like colonial yeah. views on things. And when I was little, I think I just wanted to frolic in the forest all yes. day and that be my life. Like, and he just didn't understand that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember my dad, like when we'd drive around and we saw the cottages starting to be built, and he'd talk about IBAs and he'd talk about how these First Nations are trying to build themselves up, and oh, I wish that was happening, you know, back in Saskatchewan. Like, it's so different in the Okanagan. He's like, they're doing it right. Chief Clarence is a good chief, and he's not one of those where, you know, you can tell where the chief's house is. you can see it, like, literally the next res over. Emil, remember when we saw there's a roof that literally has like the name of the chief like in the tiles?
Wow. Oh my god.
So my dad is like, well, there's two sides. It's either you're that or you're Chief Clarence leading the pack. But I really just wish I could live in a time that, like, I used to imagine when I was a kid. Like, living in... If all else fails, I will build a pit house.
Yeah, obviously.
I will build a pit house. I will build a wigwam.
Mm-hmm. I think, like, yeah, just speaking of parents and stuff, I think it's, unfortunately, like, in my family as well, like, a very... That kind of state of mind is very dominant because they lived during a time, obviously things are still mm-hmm. very far from ideal now, but when like a much more dominant rhetoric of like shaming traditional indigenous ways of life was like very, I don't know what the word is, but
prevalent.
And I think like people from that generation, like even indigenous people have just like been taught to like not believe in that and not see that as like a valid way of life, which is so sad because I'm sure like, you know, before they were taught all that, they thought those same things. Like they wanted to live traditionally and stuff like that, but they were just taught so early on in life that that was wrong and not an option.
Mm-hmm. And in my family particularly, it's so fascinating to me because I descend from a line of revolutionaries and devoutly anti the state of Canada. So not just like lukewarm. I descend from Chief Big Bear Mistahi Maskwa and Pierre Falcon, Métis poet, and a lot of very radical people who were very anti the Canadian state, very smart, very educated. Chief Big Bear outsmarted the Canadian government when they said during the treaty process the only thing they had freedom over was where to put the reserve. He secretly banded together most of the nations throughout the plains to make a plan to put them all together. He was put in prison for treason, died shortly after, but during that time, the buffalo were being killed off en masse, and we were living nomadically following the buffalo. And this was in the late 1870s, 1880s. And they were all being killed off, so people were starving, and they needed rations, but the government would not provide rations unless he signed Treaty 6. And he said, if I sign Treaty 6, this will go against all of my values. I do not want to submit to the Canadian state. This will be the death of our people and our culture. He had no choice, and he died shortly after. So what's interesting to me, though, is I descend from these revolutionaries, and that's not that distant at all. My grandpa was born the, like, either 1929 or, like, sometime in the 30s. My family, I'm, like, my parents are very old, and, yeah, my grandpa was sent to Kamloops Residential School. And he was born, his brother's birth certificate, which was, like, 2 years before, says District of Assiniboia, Municipality of Tecumseh, which was, like, the term for the Red River area. If you know about, like, the Board of Assiniboia, that was Louis Riel's government. So it's very, there's really not much documentation. It's mostly oral, so I don't really know too much. But my grandpa was born on the Red River Trail. And at that point, it was way past 1885 and Riel's execution. So everyone was kind of in shambles. And then they moved to BC to work in the lumber mills. He was sent to residential school, became a devout Catholic, became ashamed of his Indigenous identity. He would get violent if it ever came up. And he eventually passed away of alcoholism when I was like maybe 4 or 5. Mm. And my dad grew up like under that, very ashamed. But then in the 80s, 90s, him and his siblings became a lot more connected. My dad was scooped in the 60s before being returned back home. And my dad became that very colonial mindset of like, the only good thing we can do is to assimilate as much as possible into this capitalist regime, not thinking critically about it at all, thinking all these teenage boys on the res are lazy bums sitting around. And it may be true that these guys are partying and not getting jobs, but that doesn't mean that that is purely their fault and their own choosing and their own doing. Mm-hmm. And it ignores all of the systemic policies put in place specifically to oppress us and to keep us under submission. But I guess my whole point there is literally through one person in my family being put in residential school, it blocked the rest from the revolutionary like history of my family.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's where Chief Clarence Louis misses the mark on capitalism.
Yeah.
Is because, like, yes, like, we can try to use it to benefit people, but, like, it's definitely not, you know, decolonial, and capitalism was a white man's invention.
Yeah.
To control people of color from, you know, succeeding, from practicing their culture. Yeah.
And I just wish could think about it more critically, because I agree that's the best thing we can do right now is to try and get employment up on the res and try and work within the system, but I wish people would think about it more deeply. We will be playing a few ads and then we will come back for our final thoughts. So catch you on the flip. Again, you're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM in the city colonially labeled as Vancouver. Hello, one second. Sorry, we are having some technical difficulties with sending these ads your way. It's like the universe wants you to just hear our beautiful voices and only our beautiful voices. We will see if we can get this to work. So, we're back again. I'm gonna have my computer is completely failing me right now. So, let's do right here. So, catch you on the flippity flip. We won't be gone for too long.
Over and over again. Over and over again.
On January 17th, CITR 101.9 FM presents our annual 24 Hours of Radio Art Programming, featuring innovative approaches to music and sound.
Over and over.
It's 24 hours of spoken word, ambient, drone, field recordings, and sound walks, collage, technical support calls, voicemail fails, sound art, and noise. Listen live on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
Over and over again. Over and over again.
You want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both. Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing healthcare, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
Randophobic is best thought of as an introversal jukebox which has no concept of genre, style, political boundaries, or even space-time relevance. But it does know good sounds from bad. Lately, the program has been focused on Philip Random's All Vinyl Countdown plus Apocalypse, the 1,111th greatest records you probably haven't heard. And we're not afraid of noise. Randophobic, every Saturday at 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. at CITR 101.9 FM.
Hello. Hello, hello. You're listening to Lethal Refresh on... not Lethal Refresh. That's my previous show that I do with my friends from 3 to 4. You're listening to Unceded Airwaves, hosted by the Indigenous Collective. I'm Danny, our lead, and I'm here with two of our members.
I'm Olivia.
I'm Audrey.
Yes, and we've been talking to you about Indigenous economics with a specific focus on Dr. Charles Menzies here at UBC and Chief Clarence Louie, who we have dubbed the pull yourself up by your moccasins capitalist. So I guess what I want to see in my lifetime, I guess I can really speak on OIB because that's where I grew up. That's my home community. I would like to see those slogans be taken down. I really just, there's so many, like I couldn't quote all of them, but they're everywhere. They are literally everywhere. And I wish we could have the benefits with the critical understanding as well, like with the approach of this is more short term, because it seems that with Chief Clarence's policy, the 100-year leases, he wants this to be a thing that continues way on, which I feel like Dr. Menzies comes from the approach of this is what we can do right now within the loopholes that we can find in the systemic policy. But eventually the goal is to occupy, to reclaim traditional practice and traditional ways of living. But Chief Clarence's goal is to see natives in Lambos.
Yeah.
That's so funny that you say that. This is random again, but I literally almost got hit by a Lambo today.
Oh, no.
So the universe is connecting. I'll say this. I mean, I'm from the Métis Nation, so it's a privilege to, you know, already be kind of in control of our own governance. Mm-hmm. But there is people above that connect federally that still have, like, strong colonial values.
Very much so. I feel like the roots of Métis identity have very much been lost. Like, I come from, there's, like, we've talked about Scrip on previous episodes. I come from Indian half-breed Scrip, which is, there's French Scrip, there's half-breed Scrip. There's these different categories and classes of Métis. But I come from the Métis that lived the most traditionally and were classified the same under Scrip as they would. It literally said something like, lives like an Indian or something. Lives among the Indians like an Indian or something. It's ridiculous.
That is ridiculous.
So I feel like in Métis Nations, especially, I am, if MNBC, Métis Nation British Columbia, has zero haters, I'm dead. I can guarantee that.
So yeah, I guess I'd say I want to see us frolicking more. Mm-hmm. I think we should embrace frolicking. Support that.
When I think of traditional Métis, I just imagine a bunch of, like, almost piratey kind of guys around Pioneer with, like, tin, like, mugs around a campfire, like, drunk singing Métis anthems. I want more of that and less of Métis people trying to get land rights and fishing rights in places that are not ours. What would you like to see, Audrey?
It's hard. I didn't grow up on, like, my nation's land. I grew up on Vancouver Island, which is very, very white. Mm-hmm. And I also grew up in a small town, and I went to private school when I was in middle school and high school. So my grandfather also went to residential school, and as a consequence of that, my family has also lost, like, some connections to
following the colonial structure.
And I think I can't really speak too much on the economics of my nation because I honestly just don't know too much about it, but I think what has been really important to me is kind of what we were discussing earlier, just that thing of, you know, it only takes one person in your family for things to change so much for future generations. And it's really frustrating, especially growing up in, like, a very white area and Indigenous culture not being spoken about much.
Yeah.
This idea that colonialism is a thing of the past and, you know, residential schools don't affect people anymore because they're over.
Mm-hmm.
And all the things that we've been talking about Indigenous people being blamed for their own economic state or financial state and not attributing that to ongoing settler colonialism. I think just more knowledge about that, people becoming more educated about that, I think is really important to Indigenous economics and just Indigenous futurity.
Yeah, I really want people to actually have an understanding of what land back means. And I think there was, like, this tweet, and it was, like, white people thinking that land back means they will be ethnically cleansed from the land is a fascinating case of projection.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I wish people actually really understood what we want. And I feel like even my own family, like, some of my siblings are more traditional and others are still very much affected by colonialism a lot more and would say, how you believe in land back if you have an iPhone and Instagram. And I wish we could get to a point where people have at least more of an understanding of how you can critique a system and also live within it. And I feel like if people had more understanding of that, it would be better. And also I hope for the older generations to not feel like they have to constantly be battling this stereotype and proving themselves as different.
Yeah.
I definitely see that in my own aunties and uncles and my dad and my family. And like you said, it takes one person to make that change. So for me, it was my grandfather made that change from radical revolutionaries to living within the colonial system, becoming Catholic, very rigid, very structured. Mm-hmm. And then now it's like me and a few of my siblings who are making that change again to try mm-hmm. to go back to how we were before. And again, I am very grateful for the good policy that Chief Clarence put in that has allowed me to speak from this place. I do feel very privileged to be able to get up here and critique it left and right, but I did not grow up on the OIB res. I did not grow up on the OIB res before Chief Clarence's reign. And just hearing the stories of what it looked like before, I didn't live that. So I can talk as much smack as I want, but I'll never know what it was like to live on OIB before his policy. And again, I do come from, I did grow up there, live there, was raised culturally by OIB, but I still have absolutely that privilege of being on my high horse here at UBC talking about this. And I'm probably going to be going home this summer, possibly even working for Soyuz Indian Band Development Corporation again. So it's so complex, and I hope everyone can have a better understanding. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like, too, that's such a colonial perspective, being like, oh, it can only be one or the other. Mm-hmm. Like, kind of pick a side thing when it's like there's so much intersectionality between yeah. the two. It's not like pick one side or the other. They can coexist, but you have to do something and acknowledge that a certain part of it is colonial and very oppressive.
Yeah, mm-hmm. just been staring at the picture of the band office. The Native people have always worked for a living. And I mean, I literally went to so many different OIB things this summer, and I enjoyed it, and I think Spirit Ridge is so pretty, and I love driving by there, and I do giggle a little bit when I go to the band office and see they have the wheelchair like decals on the ground for like the yeah. parking spaces, but they have like a headdress on it by the band office. Oh, and there's God. So much stuff like that around OIB that I love. Like it's there's traditional like signage in Silchin on PIB and OIB everywhere. Indirectly, because of his policy, West Bank First Nation, which you may have heard of, they have literally gotten the land back. Half of the city of West Kelowna is governed by West Bank First Nation. And if you look at a map of treaties in BC, it's very interesting. And there's a lot of people who, like older people, older capitalists, who are so mad about it, who are so mad that it's in the hands of them now. But they literally govern like a Walmart, Canadian Tire, like a whole half of the city. And that's also indirectly because of his work. So two things can be true. I can be grateful for the policy he's created, but also very critical of his honestly mean and like at some points it seems very like racist, the things he says. Yeah. Like when I go into Indian people's houses. Yeah. Like that's crazy.
That's wild
to say that. Like that's the kind of thing that Lucy would not have any of. We should put Lucy in charge.
We should. That should be a...
That's the conclusion.
Yeah, that's the conclusion. Lucy 2024?
Lucy 2024. Yeah, I have no idea what the future holds. I mean, it's literally kind of a running joke on the res. Like, who is going to take over? Like, what do we do? Because he's been in power since the 80s. So it's very much like, it's very out there. But I really hope, manifesting, that there is basically just this child of like Dr. Menzies and Chief Clarence and like sociologically aware chief that is also able to maintain the same good policy. Mm-hmm. Land back.
Period.
Give it back. Please. And I guess that concludes this episode of Unceded Airwaves. You can catch us on Instagram at Unceded Airwaves, and you can email me indigenouscollective@citr.ca if you want to get involved. We need as many people as possible to help create our weekly radio show. I think next week is going to be about Louis Riel Day, because that's coming up November 16th, if I'm not mistaken. So stay tuned for that. And goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.